This is the Horse Radio Network.
This is episode 20 of Horsemanship Radio, brought to you by Index Fund Advisors, IFA.com. Horsemanship Radio is part of the family of the Horse Radio Network. So, I looked up the traditional gift for the 20th of anything, and it was china, you know, like ting, ting, ting plates. Since I couldn't think of an appropriate horse person from China, I went to Denmark instead. And we have Joan Satori Soy from Denmark and Francesca Wood today, who Francesca can easily transition from the polo world to the wild Mustang and does it quite easily. This is Debbie Laux, and you're listening to the Horsemanship Radio. Welcome back, everyone. Horsemanship Radio airs on the 15th and the 30th of the month. And I have my producer, Glenn, with me here today. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Debbie.
How's it going?
It's good to talk to you again. Hey, last week was fun. If you missed last week's episode, go back and take a listen to episode 19, because Jennifer actually produced that show and gave you a little questionnaire. A little getting to know the host's questionnaire, and I listened to it, and it was a lot of fun learning more about Debbie.
Well, it was fun for us. I don't know how everybody else handled it, but we had a good time. Kind of forgot about you. not at all. I miss you every time, Glenn.
Well, you know, we did that with all the hosts across the network, and it was neat for me. I've known a lot of these people. I've known a lot of these people, you know, my co-hosts for years and years, like you, we've known for years. And yet, I learned something new about every one of them with that segment.
Yeah,
so it was fun.
That is a lot of fun. That was a really good idea, you guys.
Well, we're going to take all of them. We're going to cut them out of the shows, take all just the getting to know the host segments, and we're going to put them all in one file.
That's fun.
If somebody wants to go back and listen to them all at once, they can do that, and we'll let you know where that is and when that's out.
So. Don't use it against us. Okay. Well, today we have a lot of fun going on. We have a couple of guests today that I think people will really relate to, even though they've got pretty extreme lifestyles. Got one that's way over in Denmark, and she's a pretty tough cookie when it comes to riding outdoors. And then we've got Francesca Wood, who really, she grew up in England, but she has an amazing affinity for wild Mustangs now. I think people will be really interested in that story. We'll introduce Francesca Wood after this commercial from IFA.com.
Hi, I'm Mark Hebner, president of Index Fund Advisors and proud owner of Monty Roberts Willing Partners graduate, He's a Sugar Bear. You know, investment portfolios are a lot like horses. You need to find one that best suits you, your temperament, and your stage of life. Some people might like an energetic horse and an aggressive investment portfolio, while others are more comfortable with a gentle ride and a more conservative investment portfolio. The trick is to find the one that's right for you. That's what Index Fund Advisors is all about, matching people with portfolios, risk-appropriate, low-cost, and globally diversified investment portfolios. You can find the right portfolio for you by taking the Risk Capacity Survey at IFA.com, that's IFA as an Index Fund Advisors. Or you can call us toll-free at 888-643-3133. That's 888-643-3133.
Francesca Wood grew up in England among horses, the daughter of a champion jockey and professional horse parents. Her father was her mentor and was totally a nonviolent guy with horses. Racehorses, jumpers, and his horses performed at high levels, winning major steeplechases. She has two daughters, both good riders in their own right, polo and hunter jumper. And Francesca has competed successfully with some very good winning horses in the UK, France, Denmark, and Gothenburg, Sweden. She's recently begun an odyssey into Mustang rescue and training, and we are excited to hear more about that.
Welcome, Francesca Wood, we're honored to have you on the show today. You're in Nevada?
I am indeed.
Where are you deep into Nevada?
I am in Red Rock, Nevada, which stands at about 6,000 feet in the high desert.
Well, thank you for taking the time. I know it's the middle of the day there, and it is June, so it's probably warm. But thank you for coming in from those horses. We told the listeners a little bit about your background, but you've really taken a departure a little bit from growing up in England. Tell us a little bit about how you grew up and how we came to know you eventually.
Right. Well, I grew up in Europe and in South America. My father trained horses, and so I've been around horses my whole life. And I've been, you know, a competitive rider and my father was a colt starter as well. Mm-hmm. And but he had a very broad view on horses and trained horses for multiple disciplines, which was interesting. You know, to be able to train jumpers and or steeplechase horses or, you know, start colts, he could sort of do it all, which was a great exposure for me at that time as a child and through my life. And the key thing also was, I never saw my father hit a horse or beat it up or, you know, so I grew up with a wonderful ethic as far as approaching horses.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you sure did.
It was important to him to not do that. And I'd heard about Monty through an English friend called Lord Patrick Beresford, who had attended one of his clinics while he was in America, and he told me how extraordinary he was. And that's when I first heard of him in England. And then when I came to California, to work as a whipper-in for a fox hunt. And that ended. I chose to end it because they were being violent with the horses. And I happened to be in a hairdresser's shop in Bealton.
Really?
And, Monty was getting his hair cut on a Sunday afternoon. And that's how I
funny.
Met him.
That is
he
wild.
He recognized an English accent, yeah. And so we started talking about mutual friends in England.
No kidding.
And I had foils in my hair. Very unglamorous.
Foils in your hair. We all know what that looks like. Sorry.
Yeah. So it was quite embarrassing, really, but he did invite me over to the farm, and I rode a couple of horses, and he asked for my resume, and he was on his way to England at the time, and so he took it with him and some photographs, and Pat and him basically sort of mulled over the possibility of creating something for me. That flag is up, and he had a number of thoroughbred horses that people had left behind during the thoroughbred crash of, you know, the economy and people just leaving horses.
Yes. What year was this,
Francesca? So I managed to sell. I'm sorry?
Yeah. What year was that?
I think it was 2009.
Yeah. So the downturn had hit. Yes.
Yeah. And there were seven different horses and one Irish sport horse. They were all thoroughbred horses that had, you know, as young as two and three, and obviously they had missed their turn to go to the track and weren't even registered properly, and but beautiful horses, and I sold, or placed rather, and you know, they were sold to people in Virginia and became steeplechase horses, and then my own daughter, Isabella Wolf, had one of the fillies by Benchmark, and which is now playing high goal polo. And, and she had been started at Flag. So that's how I came into it. And it was sort of an exchange for me learning and doing some of the courses learn about and be lucky enough to sort of immerse myself at Flag for, you know, a good amount of time, really, which was, you know, something you just can't buy. Being immersed in it and learning so much while I was there, and I was just so impressed by the whole thing. And for me, as a horse person who'd really sort of what I call heard it all as far as how to correct horses, how to train horses, how to do it, Monty really changed my life. And gave me this entirely new window of viewing of horses and how to approach, just colts and then the Mustang. You know, just the fundamental language of equus is what I've been trying to learn this whole time.
That's what I think that is just fascinating. That you did you think of the horses having a language before you got it? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not really, no. I did everything really by feel. And if I did have a problem horse, I would try and figure out how to do it. And sometimes was really stumped and really couldn't get past certain things beyond just Band-Aids, if you know what I mean, as far as a remedial horse or horse that started to quit jumping or something like that. There was no one who could really say, other than giving it a good smack, what to do. Teach him a lesson, that kind of thing. And that never really sat well with me, and therefore Monty's amazing ability to actually articulate things, things for horses and the language of equus and its detail and intellectual detail to me was amazing. And I'd never had that many alternatives put out there as far as, especially for the wild horses and stuff. But how it's applied to everything, it just, for me, one of the most important things was being very consistent and predictable. And, around the horses and never, not that I lost my temper with horses, I didn't, but the security that I've been able to give these wild horses has been that routine of coming into the pen, being the same the whole time. And then they invest in you.
Right. Had you started horses before, Francesca? Yeah, you had? Okay.
Yes. Lots of horses in England for three-day events or, there was a sort of classic start. I was lucky enough to be with a very good trainer of horses. Again, a woman who was a rider at Badrington and then became an international dressage judge. And she was really, I was a working student. I did all the good stuff. A working student does, but also I did a lot of riding for her. And we did start colts because she bred her own horses.
Ah, good. Yeah.
But we did it the old-fashioned English way, which was a very slow process, but, we'd get on in the stall and stuff like that.
Yeah.
These days it would be and the stalls were tiny.
A little crazy, yeah.
Right. But on the other hand, these were well-handled horses.
Right, from womb, right?
Yeah, they were very easy. They didn't have any complexes of people or any of that. So it went very well, usually. I can't remember one that didn't go well because the start was always good.
Did you use the classic British Horse Society book, BHS kind of? I think that's worldwide.
Well, I did get, when I was 17 or 18, everybody took this little exam called the British Horse Society Instructors thing, and, that was standard fare, but that was part of one's education as far as horse stable management, which it was useful for. Identifying, colic, identifying a strained tendon. All that kind of thing. It wasn't so much, the riding part was very minimal, but I was riding so much that, it was a no-brainer for me to do that particular thing. I got like 98% on my exam.
Yeah.
But, it was good to, it was a really good introduction to stable management. But beyond that, I wasn't interested in being a teacher. I was interested in being a rider at that point.
Right.
So I didn't pursue the system, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It's a BHS, kind of thing.
Yeah. But, so I'm curious how do you end up with this golden opportunity to further your experience with untouched horses?
Well, it was kind of a leap of God. It was really when I left Monty's, left California and came to Nevada. I was married and my husband had a job here, and the house happened to be in Palomino Valley, where the Mustangs are housed by the hundreds. And I'd go past them every day. And I had my own horses coming up from California, and one of them was one of Monty's really nice horses. And I had horses from, I had six horses of my own that I was starting to do things with. And I kept going past the pens, and then one day I just thought, well, you know what? I'm going to just see if I can even find one I like. Mm. And, you can't go into the pens, so you have to view them from outside. You're not allowed to touch them. Obviously, they can't be touched. So it was an exercise in finding the kind of horse that I would like anyway. I mean, the kind of horse that I would like to have in my barn. It was no different as far as what I looked for in a horse.
Okay.
It's just it was far harder to choose one because you weren't able to touch it. You were only able to see it herded one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
He went into the pen. We went in the truck so I could get a look at her confirmation.
Okay.
And I thought, you know what? I'd really like to see if I can do this from the beginning, because it wasn't as if I'd never started a horse. I'd started horses, but I wanted to see specifically if I could use everything that I knew that, so far.
Yeah.
That I'd learned from Monty.
The ultimate test.
It was in the purest form, as far as I could see. These were really wild horses. They weren't range horses. They were wild.
I might even add that they're a little worse than wild because they have now been rounded up, mixed up. They're probably wilder than a wild horse, because they've been handled so nicely.
A horrible, horrible experience, very traumatic. All their families have been split up. They, no longer have that family. And the first encounter has been so traumatic with the helicopters and being separated and, herded into trucks and carted off to the BLM, and having traveled far more miles than is legal, in these roundups with these helicopters. And so they had absolutely no investment in getting to know me.
It's good.
None. And the first thing they do is they twist their ear. They put them in a chute. They twist their ears as hard as they can to get a halter on.
Oh.
And there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. So these are Mustangs.
And then they attach a rope.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Attach a rope.
They attach a rope to the horse and they shoe it into a trailer.
Tough.
And they delivered it to me because I was like 5 minutes away. So they actually, because I didn't have a trailer at the time, so they just shoved it in the trailer. And I had my round pen. There were certain specifications as to the height of the panels because Mustangs will climb if they need to.
Yes.
So they had to be 8 feet high and so on and so forth.
It's an Indian horse or a Mustang? Do you know Francesca? I know that
she's definitely a Mustang, and I'm actually going to send her a couple of hair
DNA
with the root in it just to get her DNA because she's just turned out to be such a spectacular little horse.
Interesting it will be to see if she's got some Spanish barb.
To see. And actually. Your mother, Pat, when she saw a photograph of her, thought, well, she thought she was a very pretty horse, but also she looked almost like she had a little bit of a head of an Arab, you know, some barb in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
And she moves like a much bigger horse, you know, than she is.
So how long from the time that you adopted her to you actually forayed out on her back? How long was that process? Yeah.
Well, I really took my time.
Good.
You know, I sort of did it just probably entirely a year before I actually got on her, because I got her only as a two-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So I did all the groundwork that summer, that the tarp work and the halters and the long lining and the join-up and all that kind of thing became really solid. Mm-hmm. And then I let her have time off, which, again, is very English approach. But here it gets so cold in the winter, you really can't do anything constructive unless you have an indoor.
Yeah.
So she ended up that summer just being very solid and personable and just a really nice horse to handle from the ground. I introduced her to water, being hosed down, all that kind of thing. Everything I could possibly think of that Monty would suggest in the starting process, mm-hmm. but times 10, because you're starting with a minus score.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
That's right.
You know, and so, and obviously Monty can do these things so swiftly, but I would, you know, just double check everything I was doing. And if I made, when I made mistakes, I would, often I would call him. I'd say, you know, this isn't, you know, working. Have you any suggestions? And, you know, as long as I had my question ready.
A lifeline.
You know, he'd always answer. And it was just so nice of him. And I felt, you know, wow, this is really cool that he, and he knew exactly what it was.
Yeah, he'd seen it before.
Yeah, it's like been there, done that, and so I knew he would be able to answer it specifically with these with these Mustangs. And so by the time I got on her, it was really a no-brainer for her.
That's nice.
You know, I'd leaned on her both sides just as I would in England. I'd slapped the pack, I'd walked her around, I'd done all the things I would have done with a colt, but the long lining and join up was the key in the beginning.
So
her in the eye and all that was key in the beginning.
Right.
But, I mean, truly key. And now it's a habit. I just don't do it. I just don't look horses in the eye when I'm trying to work with them to start with.
So it's a little bit like
sending them away, obviously.
Well, that's right. Yeah. Except when you want them to go away. That's right.
Yes,
that is
exactly.
Their language.
I mean, that's, yeah.
A lot of people say that when they work with a horse and then they try to switch to a wild animal like a deer, that the flight mechanism is 100 times greater for that animal. Do you feel like it was, you know, like 100 times more difficult? Yeah, for a wild horse.
The pressure zone was fascinating to me because first of all, even though she was 2 years old, barely 2 years old, she was on her own in a round pen in the middle of a valley. She didn't even whinny, which I thought was really interesting.
They're
she
quiet.
Did not make a sound.
Yes.
And I thought, that's survival.
Yeah, tell us. That's right. That's right, because those that are identified are eaten.
Yeah. Mm. Exactly. And that was, you know, all these small things that I... You know, you fully expect a two-year-old to come in and yell, you know, make a lot of sound and all that. Nothing.
Interesting.
And then, as time went on, discovering the pressure zones, for example, when I came out of my house, which was a good distance from the round pen, she would, I would open the door and I'd look towards the round pen and she would have picked up on me coming out the door so fast, it was just like, you know, just like that. Whereas domestic horses, they don't really notice that kind of
ho-hum.
Thing.
Ho-hum, yeah.
And yeah, it's ho-hum. But also things like because it was my first winter in Nevada, I had to break a lot of ice, you know, for the tanks. Mm-hmm. And the first time it froze over, I come over to her tank. She's already broken the ice.
Oh, wow.
You know, things like that that were so interesting to me.
Yeah, yeah.
With her foot, you know, and it wasn't a stream. Oh. It was a little water tank, you know, proper 50-gallon
So she got up in it a bit.
All these other domestic horses were standing around waiting.
Waiting for you. That's funny.
And, you know, these were just like gifts to me to realize just how incredible these horses are, you know. And although she was extremely wild, I mean, you know, she was bucking around the pen and stuff like that, and I thought, Francesca, you really have been off more
what have
you
thought of?
I was thinking to myself, this is okay. Well, we'll see, type thing, if I can do this. But, you know, the thing about the Mustangs that I find so fascinating is that they give you an opportunities to work with them. And that's what you have to learn to see, are those opportunities. That I think Monty calls them training opportunities or working with them opportunities. Mm-hmm. That you stumble upon them, you know, and then I can apply something Monty has told me, like, for example, the visual, the two sides of the horse, the way it sees things, and particularly on the trail, although she's completely at home on these incredibly, you know, precipitous rock-faced mountains I'm on right now. Mm-hmm. The first time I went out with her, you know, to show the horse something that it's a little bit afraid of, both sides, and keep going and never stop and look at something, right. But keep the horse moving past stuff. That was invaluable.
Yeah.
To understand the visual process that horses have. And that, you know, working both sides of the horse and having it so it can see you all the time was so key with the Mustangs, especially around their rear ends.
Ah, right. Deadly. Deadly. Before you know it. That's right.
Oh, yeah. And so, you know, but I made so many errors or blunders, I suppose, but they're magnified, you know, so much. Just things like even, just the smallest gesture, like scratching your head with one of these horses to start with, is an event for them. I mean, taking your ball cap off or your helmet is an event for them.
Yeah. Imagine through those eyes. Yeah, through those eyes, they have never seen any of this stuff that we take for granted.
You can assume nothing.
Yeah.
That they know, you know. So one has to be so diligent.
Yes.
And precise, but at the same time, they're giving you an awful lot.
Yes.
You know, and that's the fascinating. Has been the fascinating thing with me. And then
are they more? Do you think they're more generous than domestic horses that way?
Yes.
Okay.
I do, because their curiosity can overwhelm their curiosity is really what gives you the training opportunities. Because they want to investigate things because their life depends on it.
You know, yet like they're such. They're great energy preservers, though, I know, too. And I don't mean that in the ha-ha sense that we say about some lesson horses, but that they they can live on air, practically.
Yes.
And they do want refuge quite a bit. And
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they, you know, I was surrounded by them within the Palomino Valley because it borders the Pyramid Lake tribal area reservation, so a lot of them would come over the mountain. So I had a chance to see them in the wild around me at the same time having one.
Oh, and there that's was cool.
One, Yeah, and there was one event when she jumped out of the field. Mm-hmm. And there was a band coming through at the time.
Oh.
And off she went with her winter rain sheet on.
Oh, dear.
She was gone for 3 days.
Oh, no.
Yes, 3 days.
Oh, you must have been worried.
Well, that's
sick.
It. I'll never see her again.
Yeah.
And all through the valley she was seen, because obviously she was running with a herd.
She's the only one with a sheet on.
Yeah, the rain sheet on.
Hard to miss.
It's like, what? But her brand is very big, so they could see she was a Mustang.
Ah, good.
And she went for 3 days with the family. And then she came back.
No kidding, Francesca.
She
that's so cool.
Came back to us.
And how long had you had her at that point?
I'd had her probably a year. Yeah.
That's so cool.
She's decided, hey, this is a lot of work being out there.
It
she
is.
She must have lost like 50 pounds. But
oh,
she did not.
Dear.
She didn't have a mark on her. Not a mark. And I saw them going up over the rocks and disappear.
So she it's interesting that... The band took her in then, as far as we know,
they
too.
But apparently from people who'd seen her, she had to try and keep up with them. You know, they didn't really want her there. But she kept going.
Horse of a different color with that sheet on anyway.
Yes, it's like, what the heck is this?
Yeah, it looks like a detriment.
Exactly. So, but luckily she had one of these slaps over her tail. So
okay.
I'm thinking, oh my gosh, she's going to get bread or something awful, you know.
That's funny.
But luckily they didn't go there.
Yeah, and there you go. The downside.
But I was amazed that she could find her way back.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of times, I fell off in the desert because she spooked so quickly. Mm. But she stayed with me.
Oh.
That was the thing. That was when she was really a baby. She stayed with me. She didn't try to run away.
What a relationship.
They weren't major falls, but, you know, they're so sharp, you know, when they change direction.
Yeah.
It was like, oops, okay. But
yeah,
let
how'd
me
I
get
end up,
on
yeah.
her. But, you know, all that stuff that I learned from Monty about standing still, you know, the whole standing, learning to stand still. She stood still every time I got on her.
Yeah,
that kind of thing was golden. The value of standing still was just huge.
Fantastic story. What a fun story.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do with her now? Is there a goal for her life or a job?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. She's one I want to keep because I've decided that I thought it would be fun to do the endurance on her.
Ah, yeah.
And I've started working with a couple of really good riders who've done the Tevis and, you know, which is a big deal out here. But in general, there are loads and loads of distance riders here. Everything from, you know, people who go for a 2 mile walk to people doing 100 miles, 50 miles, 75 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And so far I've just done, I started legging her up in January, and going out. And I did, you know, I've done 10 miles and 10 miles, and it's like, you know, over a period of time. She can now easily do a 20 mile, and I'm actually preparing for a 25 mile thing that's happening up here.
Is that this month?
She's used to the altitude, and she's just, I mean, I've been walking and jogging, that's all. Walking and jogging and climbing. I'm learning about heart rate and recovery.
Right.
My vet happens to live down the road.
Good.
And she's doing it. And
she's
the heart monitors. Yeah.
She's doing the endurance with you? She's part of the competition?
Well, she's got a four-year-old as well, forecoming five-year-old.
Uh-huh.
So we do some together, but mostly I ride on my own, which is crazy, but I do. But I do trust this horse.
You're amazing, Francesca. I cannot believe what you've accomplished, not only over your whole lifetime, but just especially in the last few years. And
well, yeah.
You've got grown daughters who are fantastic horse riders, too. But well, you know what? They got to keep up with you, Francesca.
Well, I don't know. I just, you know, my interest through Monty, I mean, honestly, between you all at Flag, it was like having just this whole window of opportunity. And then I created something out of it as far as, although I'm not obviously an instructor, I wanted to see just my you know, my curiosity is what has fueled this, and my admiration for these horses.
You've helped all of us grow. Yeah, I appreciate your time today. You've helped us grow in admiration for you and the horses, certainly. But what insight that that you're able to share and give. I would love to have you back to follow along with the story of these. How many Mustangs are you riding right now or have
at
right
the
now?
At the moment, I've been here about 8 weeks, 8 or 9 weeks, and I have six Indian horses that were untouched that were rescued from the slaughterhouse sale at Fallon, and then one Mustang. You know, the difference is, I mean, they're all the same in the sense of being on the range. I mean, none of them have been protected in any way. Mm-hmm. And so starting from scratch, from no halter even. And I'm now longlining. And I've got four really on their way. I mean, there are photographs up of them having their feet trimmed now.
Oh, fantastic!
So that was a major thing for me.
That is. Are you? Where can we find you? Are you on Facebook, Francesca, or do you have a website?
I'm on Facebook.
Facebook, Francesca Wood.
I don't have a website. Yeah, just on Francesca Wood, and I document what's going on. As the little bit of progress goes along. And then I'm also documenting my rides on the filly.
Oh, fantastic. Well, it'll be fun for people to follow you and support you.
It's like wide open here because it's all BLM land I'm on. Obviously, adjacent to. And Jessica Gardner is the person I have to thank for this opportunity because she'd been trying to get hold of me for a long time, and I, you know, was going east and this and that. And I said, okay, you know, finally she said, please, you know. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about Jessica was that she knew that what she didn't want was the Western way that everybody was saying, come on, you got to do it this way. And we had previous conversations about what I did and how I did it and through Monty and all that. And I signed her up for the uni.
Ah, the Equus Online University. Thank you.
Yes,
that's awesome.
That was the first thing. And this was like 6 months ago, at least. Mm. And that's when she got these horses.
Thank you, Jessica.
Yeah, and her husband. And she's not a horse person. She's really a scientist. She's a range. She's a plant specialist, a grass specialist, and all of that. But, she, you know, she loves animals, and she's not afraid of anything. But so she's been working or viewing what I'm doing, and the goal is to have these horses find a future, and her placing them, and, you know, me helping her do that and have her be able to manage her own four that she's going to keep, you know, broodmare.
Well, good. Support you in that goal.
Hi, I'm Monty Roberts. And I know that I'm transforming the lives of horses globally. You can learn to do it too on my Equus Online University. There's a new lesson on there each week, all the way from join up to advanced. Watch world's champions give their lessons. Join at MontyRoberts.com. Go to my Equus Online University. You can transform your horse too.
Joan Sartori say, is from Denmark, and she is a wonderful student of the horse. She has had a wonderful upbringing in riding and showing, and she felt compelled and has done a great job to mentor children. She puts together camps for children in Denmark, and she has an interesting perspective that children weren't born with a whip in their hands, and probably shouldn't be trained to use one as well. She has pulled away from the traditional pony club memberships and the real structured horsemanship and decided to create for herself and for her own children the ability to put camps on that teach horsemanship from the ground up, naturally, the way it should be done. Welcome, Joan Satori Sully. I'm so glad to have you as our guest here all the way from Denmark. But that's not where you are right now, right?
Nope. I am at Flagstaff Farms right now in California, Solvang, California. I'm very happy to be here.
I'm glad you are, too. That's why I roped you into this, because Denmark, it's harder to catch up with you. You have a wonderful program that I would love to share with the listeners today about that you feel fairly convicted about back in Denmark. And I would love to hear how your children's program got started.
Yes. Well, I would love to talk to you about that, Debbie. It so happened that when I entered motherhood, I and my own two girls wanted to attend riding lessons. I found that the traditional riding schools really hadn't changed much since I myself went to one back in the 70s. And I was very sad to find that many of the horses is looking like they look suicidal because they're treated really harsh. And many of the kids are still learning just to have a whip in their hand. That is the number one equipment for learning to ride, I suppose, is a whip in your hand. And the only difference I've found from my old childhood riding schools is that nowadays you can have whips in all kind of wonderful colors, twisted like a candy cone and bling bling. And the kids are taught by adults that it's okay to hit horses. And that is so much against my philosophies of how you should be around horses. So I was thinking, well, instead of being all upset about it, why don't I just start my own riding school and show it can be done different? So I did. I started my own little riding school. And at my riding school, whips just do not exist. That's the number one rule.
No whips. So, I love it.
Yep. So that's the first thing. They will learn, the kids learn how to ride without a whip in their hand. And, it really isn't rocket science, is it? But I experienced that kids have asked me how I make my horse go forward if I don't have a whip.
Yeah.
And that alone tells me that a riding school with these kind of philosophies is most needed.
Very good. That's right. So what do you answer when they say, but my horse won't go forward without a whip?
Well, I teach them, I tell them that it's not a question about whipping a horse to make him go forward. You want him to want to go forward, and you want the horse to be happy to work with you. So, of course, the horse will go forward. I mean, he went forward like 50 million years ago without any help from human beings.
Of course,
he will go forward. we talk about how they feel themselves. I mean, if they were whipped to go clean their room, would that make it any more fun? I mean, so I know it's kind of harsh to say, but you know, the kids understand. They never enrolled riding lessons to learn how to strike a horse. They enrolled riding lessons to be able to ride out in the sunset with a very best friend, four-legged friend, and they love horses, so why would they hit them? But they're taught, many times they're taught to hit the horses. So we simply do not do stuff like that at my riding school. It's called Range E, by the way. And it's very important to me that the kids learn to be around horses with a lot of fun and joy. And it's important to me that that the focus is about being with horses and being with peers' kids and have a good time. So I also make sure that it's not so important what they wear. It's, of course, a safety issue. It's very important that they wear a helmet and that they wear good leather boots. But we don't do so much in expensive equipment and outfit and looks. We just want to play and have fun and learn. Very important. We want to learn.
I love that. And you have sort of Western-based riding, which is interesting in Denmark. I don't know if that's non-traditional too, probably, huh?
That's really not very traditional to do. But I, first of all, my heart belongs to Western, so that's a very good reason why I choose Western. But also, it gives us the opportunity for riding in jeans only. I mean, so, and the parents love that, that they don't have to go out and use spend a lot of money on expensive outfits. The kids can just show up in jeans and boots. Come on. And then I provide the helmets and the safety vest. But another thing is that, you know, out of, right now I have 20 students. Good. And 4 of them is boys. The boy number 5 is hanging on the fence, still trying to convince his parents that he should attend riding lessons. But, you know, this is a lot of boys. And I know why. Because they don't have to dress up.
Yeah, that's right. None of the pink and purple polka dots and all the things that go with a lot. And you lived in Colorado for a couple of years, I know. So is it, do you have a kind of a Western feel to it? Because I would think that would attract boys as well.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. You need to repeat the question.
You lived in Colorado for a couple of years, and we all know that that's the wild, wild west out there in the Denver area. But is there sort of a cowboy theme to this in Denmark? Or, I mean, that would attract boys. I'm just thinking out loud here.
Oh, yeah, that's true. There do exist Western riding in Denmark, and actually they're pretty good, too. Mm-hmm. So the level of Western riding in Denmark is pretty high. There's not so many Western riders compared to dressage and show jumps, of course. Yes, living in Colorado was the number one aspect for me, to bring in the Western, Western theme.
And
I was so lucky in Colorado that I met some very nice cowgirls, and one of them, Tiffany Doverspike, she taught me a lot about Western riding, as much as I possibly could learn within 2 years. Mm-hmm. And she was teaching kids herself. So I went as her helper, and I watched how she did, and I got lots of good ideas from Tiffany Doverspike, that's for sure.
Great.
I always thought.
Yeah. So if somebody, I'm thinking about the moms that are listening to this who maybe have a couple of kids that are thinking, this is a great idea to kind of go non-traditional from the pony club route and get the kids involved. Did you have a riding school to begin with, Joan?
If I had a riding school to begin with.
Did you have a riding school with lots of horses to do this, or did you start with nothing?
No, I started out with almost nothing. I'm so lucky. I do have a little farm. Mm-hmm. I did have a barn, and I do have a little arena. I had 2 horses to start out with, and I borrowed one from a good friend. Mm-hmm. And then I went out to find good little ponies that, you know, maybe not worth so much to other people, but to me they're worth a lot if they are good and steady bump-proof horses. And one of them I got really cheap, and I just rode him myself for 2 weeks, and he was ready. And with the method of training horses that I learned here with Monty Roberts, I mean, you can get very far pretty quick if you do it the right way. And so I must say, I of course, my horses, I train them only with the Monty Roberts method. Huh. And they're very, very good with humans. They're very good with the kids. And the kids, of course, I teach them a lot of my knowledge from I learned here with Monty Roberts. And
that's nice.
Yeah, you know, just the fact that they don't approach the horse with eyes on and send the horse away without knowing it. They know not to have eye contact. They know how to position themselves to the horse. So just by that, and then with the whole non-violent environment, I'm sure that
that's very much the reasons why the horses are cool. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, to go back to the questions, no, I had the facilities to start a riding school, but I have built it all up from the very beginning, yes. And it's still not very big. Please know that I have 6 horses mm-hmm. and 20 kids coming, but...
That sounds ambitious to me, Joan. I think that sounds like a lot to chew off, but you do it well. So do you teach them? I'm intrigued by the groundwork and the riding work. Do you start with groundwork and then go to the riding, or is it does it come together naturally?
It comes together because they come to me because they want to ride. So if I teach them, you can't. You have to start from the ground.
Yeah.
They will lose interest really quick. So I start out putting them bareback on my best horse. And I teach them how they can actually stop a horse without pulling the head. I teach them that it's okay, you can stand up on a horse and you can stand on one leg on the horse. And so they find out that, okay, this is very much not traditional. And it's really fun. And they taught from the very beginning that on my really, really bump-proof horse, that if they put their legs forward, lean back, say ho, the horse will stop. And they will remember that. When they have reins in their hand, that why would you pull the head? You know it can happen that you can stop a horse without pulling his head.
Excellent. That is excellent advice. Do you teach the join-up to the children, too? Do they do a join-up with the horses, their horses?
They will in the future. Because right now I'm here at the Flag Is Up because I'm an internship student. So I just passed my exam. And I am not allowed to teach join-up until I'm fully certificated.
Oh, it was a trick question. Sorry, I didn't mean that. But
no, it's okay. It's okay. But so I never taught them join-up, but I did have a permission to tell them about it and do some experiments due to my exam preparation.
That's right.
So I was allowed in written that I could do that. Before I came. So, yes, I have experimented a little bit with that, and you can't do it like you can with adults. You have to, again, you have to anger it from different angles.
Of course. It just seems like such a natural way to get people, get kids excited about the whole thing, to be able to communicate with the horse.
And after I tried the first time, you know, when they came to me for the next week, when they came back for riding lessons, they asked me, hey, can we go to the round pen instead? Because they loved it.
It is cool. I don't know any adults who don't think it's cool, so I can't imagine a child that would think it's not cool.
This
big horse that you're communicating. Yeah.
That's really nice.
And you told me a little bit about how you choose these horses for the children. Mostly you're just looking for their little personalities and their attitudes. You don't have a particular breed that you're in love with or anything like that. Is that right?
No, that's true. I absolutely love quarter horses. I have to say that. But there's a lot of expenses connected to having a quarter horse in Denmark. So having a full riding school full of quarter horses would be...
Woohoo, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. it's not going to happen. But I don't know why, but Haflinger comes my way all the time.
Oh, yes.
And I do love Haflingers. They're really nice and good horses.
Yes.
So
yes.
I do have
good horses. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. How did you get into horses, Joan? Were you born into horses?
No, not at all. I'm the first one in my family who had this huge interest for horses. Actually, I'm from a working... a labor family. I grew up in the city, and it took me from 0 years to 8 years to convince my parents that they needed to put me in a riding school.
Aww.
And back in the 70s, I know it was a rich kid hobby.
So, a hobby,
Yeah, is that the right word? Did I say something wrong?
That's right. No, that's right. I just want to make sure they understood the word. Yes, it was a hobby back then, and it seemed like an expensive hobby probably to parents.
Absolutely. Huh? And I don't think that my dad, he was an electrician, I don't think he bragged much about that his daughter attended riding lessons. I don't think he told anyone. But, so I went on my bicycle long distance to be on the countryside and just be around horses. So it was but something I really, really, really wanted, and it was the only thing on my mind. I remember in school, I could just look out the window, and there was this cartoon in my brain going in front of my eyes, just with horses, horses, horses.
Oh, you just imagine.
And it hasn't changed, really, Debbie. It's still the same.
you're still gazing out the window during your exams, huh? Well, I know you're really talented. I've seen you work with horses, and it's really exciting to have somebody that's that talented but that dedicated to the horses and to the future of horses and to our children with horses. So I was really excited to have you on this. I would love to have you back, Joan. Now I know you're not 25. You've spent years now with horses, and I would love to hear some of your expertise in horses and have you back for a tip if you'll come back.
I will, absolutely. Thank you so much for your kind words, Debbie, and I would love to come back. Thank you.
We admire you. Thank you for your advocating for horses, too. Today's trainer's tip, we're changing up a little bit today. I thought it'd be interesting to have a Q&A that Monty Roberts has covered recently that brought up a little bit of controversy, in a good way, I think, because it's one of those subjects that a lot of clinicians and trainers don't like to touch. But I think it's an important one that as our world gets smaller, you'll see that it makes some sense. So, Glenn, I would love, I've copied you now on this Monty's Q&A, and I'd love to hear you read the question, and then I'll give Monty's answer as best I can.
Okay. So it's kind of long, but try follow along, everybody, because it's important to the answer, I think, too. Mm-hmm. This is the first time my stallion has been rearing and striking since I've had him. I believe the trigger involved two things. First, we had started to teach him the Spanish walk. One does so by tapping the foreleg with the whip lightly. The stallion then lifts his leg and makes a clawing motion. Mm-hmm. This turns into a Spanish walk, hopefully. Yeah. My coach warned me jokingly just yesterday that we were teaching him how to strike. Secondly, my coach has been in the habit of using the whip on his chest to make him back. We have a dually we have used it extensively, mm-hmm. but he would try to playfully nip when I mm-hmm. asked him to back with it. So my coach tried taps on the chest with the whip, maybe ones that were at sometimes too hard. Mm-hmm. I believe these two things gave my colt license to strike out. The first instance with me when I was leading him, he had a side rein on the outside to prevent him from turning his head inward. But he got ahead of me in a corner and faced me. I tried backing him by flinging the whip toward his chest. This apparently provoked him to come at me with his mouth open. He didn't get me because he was distracted by my coach. The next incident came the same day after my coach had practiced leading him. All was fine when my coach stopped and the stallion, seemingly out of nowhere, reared and struck at him. The rope got wrapped around his leg, which stopped him from further action. That'll do it, I believe. Yeah. He has been doing beautifully until we started the Spanish walk thing, which I believe connected with the whip tapping on the chest to back. I think he's had enough. How can mm-hmm. we address this issue safely? And mm-hmm. you know what? She described it so well, you can picture all of this happening.
Yeah. And hopefully not too many of our listeners have ever seen it. But if you've been around stallions long enough, you'll know exactly what she's talking about. And here's Monty's answer. There is a strong urge within me to send you a private message regarding the horse, his behavior, and the questions that you've asked me. My private message would be short, and it would indicate that I believe that it is totally irresponsible for me to advise men or women who are not professional handlers of stallions regarding what to do with an aggressive adult stallion. I've had second thoughts on this particular situation, as it has to do with my letting the reading public know my position whenever this subject is brought to me for an answer. I suppose I've skirted the issue long enough, so here we go. This is an almighty serious situation, and it does not call for the mincing of words or the introduction of levity. Perhaps I should simply suggest that you watch the movie Buck. If you've already seen it, I suggest that you watch it again. I've talked with many people who saw the film but simply set aside what was nearly a fatal attack by a stallion on a professional horseman. There's no excuse available to any of us to treat this situation as if it had a solution that could be conveyed through any technical device available to us today. It's my hope that you will heed my advice. for one moment, please imagine that I'm an expert in the field of explosive war devices. Now further imagine that I received a request from a 12-year-old boy in Afghanistan who wants me to advise him on the best methods to defuse roadside bombs. Should I accept the challenge and try desperately to educate him? I would most likely be giving him a sentence of death. In the case of advising non-professional stallion handlers on how to deal with an aggressive stallion, I believe I would be just as irresponsible as if I were to answer this young man. Please heed my recommendations. Remember that someone in my position learns how to read between the lines. The horse is an adult stallion who has gone aggressive. You can soften the words any way you want to. Remember, you used the term, quote-unquote, playfully nipping. Also remember your words, quote, this apparently provoked him to come at me with mouth open, close quote. This horse has been whipped. He's overridden the whip by using aggressive tactics. This will increase as time goes by, and by reversing the process, and reversing this process is virtually impossible. Castration can, but not always, assist in reversing the process. This comment is virtually always responded to by saying, quote, but I want to breed with him. In the early 1960s, I traveled to the farm where a famous Arabian stallion stood at stud. A lady actually showed him and won many championships. She was entirely capable. The horse was bad. I suggested she send him to a professional breeding farm where he could be handled by several men on each occasion. My visit was on a Sunday. Her truck-driving husband returned home on Thursday to find her ripped to shreds in the horse's box stall. The husband picked up his two children at school and announced to them that they no longer had a mother. I never want this again. This is the second horse that has been brought to me this week with a story extremely similar. As the world gets smaller and we love our horses more and more, it's my opinion that these stories will be more plentiful. I now know that I have to do what I can to let people know that these animals are only doing what nature dictates they do. In this case, someone came into his world to control him, and with the violence of a whip. He decided he was bigger, faster, stronger, and totally capable of controlling his world. I want the world of horse people to know this answer. If I can help you further, please let's discuss solutions privately. Do not for one minute think that I'm telling you that the horse is at fault. I want everyone to love their horses. I want them to treat their horses in an acceptable manner and to seek solutions that are effective whenever there's unacceptable behavior. I do not want people to simply love their horses, have someone treat them with violence, and then convince themselves that it'll be okay because they love their horses. This is delusional thinking. Whether the behavior is from violence or from a total lack of boundary setting, the danger is of equal magnitude. And that's from Monty Glenn. I think that's an important statement to make out there and a subject oft not touched.
Right, and it's because people are because of the nature of the topic, it's not touched. Mm-hmm. But boy, he said it so well.
Thank you.
Analogy was very good.
It puts it in perspective, doesn't it? And we have had people write in from all over the world thanking him for that answer, and including professionals who, you know, are a bit afraid themselves of touching the subject, because how do you do that in an email, or how do you even, you know, you just can't see every situation or you know, carefully measure how to help them.
Interesting. Well, we thank Monty for that, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
For the trainer's tip. And now it's time for his calendar.
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?
Where in the world is Monty Roberts?
Monty is looking forward to meeting some new friends, two-legged and four-legged, in Solvang, California, August 4 through 8. Monty's special training at Flag Is Up Farm. And then September 20 is a night of inspiration. September 21 is life lessons with Monty and Pat, and all day. October 5, 10, October 16, 18, October 22, 24, and 30. And then November 1, he'll be on tour in England, all the way from the South Tip all the way up to Gleneagles, Scotland.
You can see more about Monty's schedule and everything Monty Roberts, for that matter, at montyroberts.com. You can find his calendar there, or you can give him a call at 805-688-6288. That's 805-688-6288. For details about today's show, go to horsemanshipradio.com, where you can find links, photos, and more information about all of our guests. As always, we love your feedback. Please follow us on Facebook under facebook.com/Monty Roberts or at Twitter at twitter.com/Monty_Roberts.
Perfect. And many thanks to our sponsors. We couldn't do it without you. Be sure to visit all the other great shows on Horse Radio Network at www.horseradionetwork.com. And until next time, have many happy horse hours.